Another piece that I did in the 80s, late 80s, was a show called Hotel Center. Now, I live on Spring Street. Across the street from me is this, well, it used to be this house of prostitution and drugs again. Just very, very, very bad. It's like every night the ambulance and fire department was there. Somebody had fallen off or pushed off or, you know, just like a lot was going on. But I liked the fact that it was called Center. Because I thought, oh, okay, it's like they become prostitutes as well. So, or even artists become prostitutes as well. So, one evening, in the middle of the night, when the prostitutes were like on opposite sides of the street, I ran across the street and stole the sign that designated that building, Hotel Center. I grabbed it because it was an ugly-looking wooden piece, and it just said Hotel Center. Grabbed it, took it into my studio, and thought, okay, this is my chicken book pottery that I'm going to base an entire show on. It's done very quickly. How do I mimic that? I'm going to use wood and maybe perhaps the door skins, the veneer of a door, because when you walk down the hotel into the hallway, all we see are doors, and the door is something that either is closed to conceal or it's open to reveal. It's kind of like all those metaphors. But it's an ugly-looking sign. So how do I, well, maybe if I paint with my left hand and I'm right-handed. So I did the entire show with my left hand, and it was perhaps the ugliest show I had ever painted. People were very fearful that, you know, I had lost it, because every show up to then was a big hit, sold out. And, you know, everybody's like, what happened to him? Why? And the interesting thing is, like, nothing sold from the show. Maybe a couple of collectors were brave and they did purchase maybe something small. But 2 years later, the Denver Museum buys a piece for the permanent collection. I heard about it. And then all of a sudden, everybody's like, oh, we've got to get one of those pieces. It's like a unique time. He did it with his left. And all of a sudden, you know, that reputation in that show overcame the fact that it was a master show. And, well, you know, like, next for me is actually that DVD we were watching is by a friend of mine, Steve LaPonce, who put together two versions of it. One is all music and one has a narration on it. And that's being done for a book that's coming out of UCLA in March of next year, which is a critical analysis of my work, which means the scholar wrote it, and it's, I don't know if it's going to be interesting or not. There's no new surprises or anything. Well, maybe a few. But yeah, that'll come out in March of next year. And I believe in January, I'm probably going another day to do artists in residence, which is something, I don't know, you know, a lot of you are artists, and perhaps that's the kind of activities you would be interested in doing. But for me, that is kind of something that has financially helped me out a bit, is to do artists in residence at universities. When I was doing an artist in residence in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the university brings me in, and they wanted to do something with art and technology. And they asked, you know, would you like to work on something with computers? And I said, yeah, sure. And then I said, you know what I would like to do is something inside of a planetarium. I would like to do this piece that is projected, and an animation piece that is projected onto the ceiling of the planetarium in a big amphitheater. And so I went, they got a couple of grants in order to have this start to kick it in. And the first question that the science people in the science department asked me is, how good is your geometry? That kind of hit me, you know, low blow. And I said, well, you know, I know it's like poetry. It's, I speak in metaphor because I'm an artist. And math is poetry. Of course they loved me for saying that. I got the job. And I did this huge, big projection piece. It's a 6-digital projection that shoots up inside of the planetarium. It's got a 5.1 Dolby surround sound music score to it. The size of the screen is 4,750 square feet, so I got good at math. And it's a huge, big projection, and we're hoping to get it, the one here in Los Angeles, for March when the book comes out. So perhaps you can see that piece. The piece is called Brain Flame. Now, that came about because I was brought in to do an animation piece, and I started to storyboard the animation, and tons of students worked with me. People that knew Maya, the computer program, helped me out. They knew a lot more than I did about computers. And then I had to leave because I had another artist in residence in Tacoma, Washington. And they were having the Glass Museum. The Glass Museum invited me to come up there. And they said, "Ron, come and do anything you want in glass. What would you like to do? Like vessels or, you know, plates or whatever you want to do in glass." And out of my mouth again came the words, "I want to do these brains, big glass brains with these stems that come out of them." Oh, that's possible. So I did some drawings, showed them what kind of brains. They weigh about 35 pounds each. They're made out of glass. There's one in the other room on an IKEA cart that's strapped to the IKEA cart. And the piece is called An Evolutionary Dead End. That's the title of the piece that's in the other room. It's got the creature from the Black Lagoon, which is an evolutionary dead end. It's not quite a man, not quite a fish. So anyway, did these glass brains, which were kind of transparent, you could see right through them. And I went back to Albuquerque after that experience. And one thing about me is I don't fly. I have been taking the train all over the United States for the past maybe 12 years now. And so everywhere I go, I travel by train. So caught the train, goes back to Albuquerque. I arrive in Albuquerque and I tell people, we have these meetings all the time, and so I just did these glass brains. Can we do a projection that has a huge glass brain that floats up above, and this person is going to go inside of it, blow up, and wherever this body part lands, it's the spark of imagination. It's like the Big Bang Theory, but it happens, we localize it here every time we come up with an idea. They go, "Bronk, calm down." That's going to take another maybe 7 months of this project. Oh, I just heard the words that we could do it. Yeah. So we did the piece. It's called Brain Flame. I did get to do the big, huge projection of a brain above the audience that scoops up this person and goes inside of it. And so that piece was done. It took 2 years to do. Now, I've done other things. Well, another animation piece came out, but it was a failure. And one day I was traveling and I had done an opera set here in Los Angeles for the Music Center. And my manager calls me up and says, "Ron, Disney wants to meet you." And I ask, "Well, what for?" "Who knows, but they own the world. Just go to their meeting." So I walk into the offices at Disney, walk into this room, there's all these men sitting around the table. They've got a file on me about that thick. I walk into the space, I take the seat at the very end, I know it's for me, and all of them are looking at me, and looking at the photograph of me in their pamphlets and stuff, and the first question out of their mouth is, "Do you know anything about Beethoven's Fifth?" Beethoven said, "Fate knocking at the front door." I got the job again. Part of the problem when I hit these things is because it's bright and sharp and long. But so I got this job. the opening set of Fantasia Part 2. Now, I thought this was like, well, they told me, it's like, well, we hired someone for Dolly in the 40s, but him and Disney, they didn't get along. But we got this abstract painter from the 40s. Now, the best thing about this, and since I've told you I don't drive, Disney had to send a limousine to pick me up every single day that I worked there. Now, of course, in my neighborhood on Spring Street, everyone thought a new drug lord has just moved into the neighborhood. Because there would be a limousine come up, pick me up, they would hand me the Hollywood Reporter, they would say, would you like your desk rolled out so that you can work on your way to work? No, could you just drive by the coffee shop that I go to a couple of times and wait? And then we'll be busy. So, but then, what happened with that project was within a couple of weeks, I started to notice things. Disney has a color palette that they're used to. And all of a sudden, I started to see these purples that I've never done. Purple is like, it's great for some people, but I just did not have an affinity in my color palette for purple. So all of a sudden, these shapes and forms started to have purple. But not only that, they started to have fairy dust all over it. And what did Tinkerbell just go across my stuff? And so all of these kinds of sparkles and things started to occur in the piece. And I just said, you know, I think we should cut our losses now. This is not going to work. So, I didn't do the project for Disney. It fell to the wayside. They hired a commercial artist to come in and take over that particular project. But a couple of months later, a film director calls me up. Grump, I'm in the neighborhood. I want you to meet me and this producer. We're in a car, we're in your neighborhood. Of course, I said, what are you doing? And, you know, picking up drugs. yeah, come on over. So, hang on. This man comes over. Very bombastic Hollywood director. It was the first thing out of his mouth when he came into my studio. Grunk, this is going to be a big step up in your career. If you do this, you can do any Hollywood movie as a production designer. If you do this movie, it's going to be a big step up in your career. And he kept on saying that over and over and over again. And of course, his producer is like just the yes person, just like shaking his head, like, or she shaking his head. Yes, yes, smile. Yes, that'll happen for you. And so, this person said, I'm doing this movie. It's about this Tex-Mex singer. And I'm like, a tear, like, artificially comes out of his eye. It's about Selena. Are you familiar with her? And I said, you mean that tacky dresser? And of course he was upset about that. No. She's this Tex-Mex singer, like crossover. I said, yeah, she's a tacky dresser, right? No, I'm wrong. I don't think, you know, that's not kind of the direction. It's like, and I like, well, how do you see this movie that wrong? And I said, well, you know, Fellini, exaggerated, over the top, surreal. And he goes, well, no, you see, I'm a very humanitarian kind of director. And of course, my eyebrow raises, and I'm like thinking, oh, can I be in Corpus Christi, Texas with this man? I don't think so. What happened was, he started to say again, this will be a big step up in your career. And I said, wait a minute. I just did a project with Disney. Disney sent a limousine to pick me up every single day that I've worked there. Can you do that for me? They like look at each other like, no. Then it's a step down for me, not a step up. His jaw fell to the floor. He turned around and started to walk in the other direction to recoup. But then I notice, and this happens to men after they reach an age of 40, gravity has an impact on their bodies. He had the flattest ass I had ever seen on a map. It just went entirely across, very flat with all the wrinkles that went up the pants. And I thought, okay, this man is used to giving orders and telling everybody else what to do. That's why he has that flat ass. A lesson in life, look at the next time you go for a job interview, take a look, because if the person has a flat ass, that means you're going to be doing all the work for them. So I called up my manager and I said, you know what, I'm not interested in doing this movie. And my manager said, Grant, have you seen his other movies? And I said, well, after talking to him, I had to. I had to go see what he had done. And he did this movie called Mi Familia, My Family. And I told my manager, I have a new name for this man. His name is Greg Woods, because of what I just got from seeing is Plan 9 from East LA. It was one of the worst movies I had ever experienced. It was cliche after cliche, stereotype after stereotype. So I said no to Selena and I did this. Are there any other questions? Did Peter Sellers pay me well? Well, what happens with an opera set is that it travels at times and you get royalties for the set that you design for it. And you really, for me, the Peter Sellers projects, I would like to say I would do them no matter what, because it's just an experience, it really is. And you learn so much from that process. And part of it for me, and part of the things that I love to do, and it helps my work, is the research. I'm still the library kid that goes to the library, tons of books all around me, looking at what other artists have done, researching color palettes, researching what people were reading in the 1930s, or Lorca, Salvador Dali, Luis Buñuel, all of these kinds of connections. Garcia Torres in Uruguay, all these different people. So for me, it's the research. So you're just being fed so much. It's like a college education in many ways. So for me, that was an important part of working with Peter. But I enjoyed that experience. And yes, I did get paid good. Yes.
Why don't you drive
or
fly?
Or fly. I don't like being propelled like that so quickly, and landings are just a controlled crash. And I also like the fact that a train takes so long. You really feel the difference. It's kind of the civilized way of transportation. And I enjoy that. I've met people on the train that you don't meet on flights. And it's another world there. You know, I have to admit, I have to take a sleeping car because I'm not somebody that can, sit down and spend a couple of days on the train or 3 days to get to New York. So sometimes you'll meet like an assortment of people that you probably won't meet. I'll give you an example. I was on a train trip from here to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I was sitting at the dining car. When you sit at the dining car, you come in, you sit down, and they introduce you to the people that you're going to be sitting with. They were these two little teenage girls, and they were kind of like little Lolita looking. They went to high school age, and we started to talk. And one of them says, well, I'm a musician, and she's a writer, and we're writing this poetry, and we started just to talk about art, asking what I did, and I explained, doing this piece in a planetarium, blah, 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 I do this artwork. And then one of them said to the other, said to me, you know what, when I get home, I'm going to tell my mother that I met you. And then the other one stops her. And I said, why? And she says,
Because we told our parents we were going to a friend's house and we're going to Albuquerque. And so, you know, I met these two young girls and they said, "What are you doing for breakfast? Do you want to meet for breakfast?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm in the observation car, I'm looking at all the stars go by, the moon, and all of a sudden, I hear a young girl's voice reading Madame Bovary aloud to the other girl. And I'm saying, this is the reason why I travel by train. This is so wonderful. Now, of course, there's all these young boys that are like flies going around these two young girls that are kind of just like, you know, playing their music, reading Madame Bovary. And the boys are a little bit retarded, you know. Kind of like, they think their spiky little haircuts are going to like cut into this, but it just won't happen. And they're talking about their friends that have a double mom, tomahawk, you know, just kind of like, and they're like, you know. So just that observation, that moment in time, listening to Madame Bovary, being read by a 16-year-old young girl, to me was kind of one of those wonderful things that happens.
How do you go across the world?
Oh, then you have to, yeah. Yeah, swim. Other questions? Yes.
At the opening of your show on Fifth Street, you were standing outside the candle.
Why? Well, there's a specific reason for that. It was kind of my homage, and I stayed up in the front of the place, the gallery, for the entire length of the opening with the candelabra. It was a mimic of La Dolce Vita, which a group of people go from place to place inside of a castle with their candelabras, and the party never ends. But for me, it was like, okay, this is kind of like the art walk. You go from gallery to gallery to restaurant to bar, just like that. Party just continues into the morning. So symbolically, it was kind of, this is La Dolce Vita. And I requested that people come with sunglasses. And people actually wore rings, and other people came with their little candles as well. So that's kind of the reason behind that for the open. Very subtle. Yes?
You've moved in different media. Mm-hmm. Do you do that because you find it more challenging or more growth?
Both. I never thought I would be doing glass. I never thought I would be doing an animation piece. I never thought I would be doing an opera set. Those were things that were, you know, I never thought that I would ever be doing. When I went to Dakota to do the Glass Brains, it's in an amphitheater. And so there's an audience watching as you're blowing the glass brains, and you have all these assistants. It's almost like a big show. You have fire going on in the kilns and stuff. And it's kind of like being Dr. Frankenstein almost. It's like you're there, you have like a little banana kind of attached mic to your head. And all the people are listening to every single word that you say all the time. And and so when people were there, because they would be able to ask questions, I point to them, "How long have you been blowing glass?" 10 minutes. I've never done it before. And then, you know, the next group of people would come in and ask, "How long have you been blowing glass?" "About an hour." So it was something I had never done, never experienced. But again, I moved that into more ideas, more work. And I think, you know, the animation was exciting because I've done smaller time pieces now. You learn from each experience, and people were asking me about the fact that, you know, it's such a big projection. It just like, it takes a planetarium to see the piece. I have a disc, but you can see it's small on a computer, but a computer's a flat screen. And when you work on a dome, you're working in a void. Things can shoot off into space. So it's a different kind of experience. But for me, that is something that, you know, other artists don't get to do. So for me, it's unusual to take advantage of things that, like the Chen's wife, which was about Chen Qing, one of the Gang of Four, that ends up in prison. But it goes all the way to Tiananmen Square. And so I smashed all these bikes that looks like a tank rode over them. And that was kind of the curtain for the set. And then I had to do Chinese characters, because I had the posters and stuff, banners. And of course, you had advisors who come in to see if everything is correct. And so the advisors come in, and they're all like talking about my signs. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I probably said it. And they were talking to one another, and they asked, how did you learn to do Chinese calligraphy? Well, when I was growing up, I used a spray can. And it's the same method, you know, it's one continuous stroke. So my teacher experience is, you know, has been great. Any more questions? Yes?
Is that not really as inspirational to you as it was when you first moved in? Things have changed a lot. I still think it changed a lot.
Yeah, you know, to me, it's going to always be in change. In the early part of my career and my observations, because that's why I'm here, is I want to observe these transformations, these changes that are unfolding right in front of us. The people that are wearing flip-flops and walking with dogs down the street is something different than it was like several years back. So, and I like the fact that Broadway is a third world nation, just that one street. To me, there's an excitement about that. And, you know, the diversity of people that live here, little Tokyo, Chinatown, it's to me just like you're crisscrossed with so many languages and things, and that's the beauty, and I think that stays within the context of the downtown area. But when I was here, like, say, for instance, in the 70s in downtown LA, I was researching bars. And there were a lot of gay bars. A lot of the bars that John Retchie had written about in City of Night. And that whole scene to me was fascinating. It was something that I knew that was eventually going to die out, that I had to experience that before it left. The Grand Hotel is no longer the Grand Hotel. It's not. It's going to be a condo place. So I experienced it when it was at that low point in many ways. So those kinds of things I want to experience. And I still can find things. I mean, I always say that my motto for downtown is super grotesque you. It's when grotesqueness goes full circle and it's beautiful. So it's kind of, you have to scratch beneath the surface to see that beauty. And to me, there's still discovery. There are niches, there are things. I don't drive. So I'm always walking around and observing things that most people don't. You can tell sometimes from the people that have moved here, that park here and then they leave and go shopping completely elsewhere, and all their activities are elsewhere. But for me, it's I want to experience all of this. I want to hear the street vendors that have a chant that sing Mongo Mongo Pepino Nanse. I mean, that's a musical round. You know, that's a canon. Those are kinds of things that intrigue me about downtown. There's a beauty there. Yes, of course, there's poverty. Yes, there's drugs. Yes, there's all of these other things that exist down there. And that has existed for a long time. I mean, it's been around for a while. But I pass by certain places, and I feel that, for instance, I did a show in 1984 at the Score Bar, which is now the 107 Bar. And I did it with a punk musician called Tomato DuPlenty, who was one of the screamers. And so it's called the Grunk Tomato Show. And we did it there at that bar. We configured the pieces inside the players. I don't know if people still do things like that, like use alternative type spaces. I'm intrigued by street stuff that people do. And kind of, to me, when I hear people say, oh, I moved to downtown because of the old buildings, I just love these old buildings. Well, I moved downtown because I like cities, but city to me means people. The people that inhabit the city, not just these old buildings. I mean, that's a facade there. It's the people that make up a city to me. So that is what I'm intrigued by. Yes?
I think my mother grew up in Brooklyn, and also have a case where there's more pedestrians, there's more activity.
Right.
There's some, I mean, there's a isolation of the desperation that you're attracted to?
Well, I think it's a mixture of that. I mean, you know, I say that I go in the morning to Clifton's cafeteria, where the elite of the maladjusted meet. But then, in the evening, I go to the LA Opera, where the elite of the maladjusted meet. So you can be a part of one world, and within a few minutes, be in that other world as well. That big range there, to me, is the exciting part of living down there as well. So it's not just that I'm attracted to that ugly or whatever, it's just there's a beauty there to that extreme. Yes?
Can you talk about no doubt? In other words, you were talking earlier about when you go in and someone asks the local question about, you know,
right,
they have doubt. Does that also apply to your philosophy of not being pigeonholed or just, you know, reaching out and attacking or trying different concepts and different areas of work?
You know, one of the things I think about being an artist is that you have the best job in the world because you're able to share. And it's kind of like a cliche word, sharing, but that's exactly what you do. You share. And another aspect of being that artist is that you are a teacher all the time. So when I'm with a group of kids, it could be elementary school, middle school, high school, college, senior citizen. So I want to communicate things to that big range of people and learn from them as well. I think those are kind of important things and things that a lot of artists just want that rock star kind of sensibility of being the next great artist, the next Bastiat, the next this, the next that. But for me, it is, you know, people, again. And I invite kids to come to my studio to make something, to take it back to their house, to, most institutions have educational components to, like MoCA, the LA County Museum, and I usually tap into that. A lot of other artists would not even go there. It's like, no, I don't want to give a lecture to a bunch of kids. But I do. It's kind of like, I think that's important for me. It's, giving back in many ways, and also educating people. I mean, even people that I think, you know, like live downtown in many ways, that are professionals, are not educated in art. You know, they may be lawyers, but they've got posters on the wall, you know? and so I think that there's education that has to happen in that as well. Being pigeonholed, of course, you know, a lot of the times, early on in my career, you know, I'm a person of color, scary. and you're Latino, you must be doing murals. Well, you know, you don't say that about Brokowski. He is this artist that does installations. And usually I'm referred to as, oh, he did a mural. Well, I did a parody of the girl, I taped somebody to a wall. That's different. But another aspect is that there is such a big variety of people in the United States that is not reflected in museums. There are a lot more women that are artists that are not inside of those museums, people of color. And sometimes, I'm one of the first people that walks to the front door with the museum director right next to me. And I'm walking to his office, and the people, of course, that clean up are usually Filipino, black, brown. And they come to me afterwards, so surprised, we never thought we would see somebody like us be with the museum director, go to the office, and then we have everything you want to do. So it is rare, I mean, in many aspects. But it's also an arena that I've chosen to participate in. And, you know, there are artists that are out there that are doing things that are comparable to anything that's going on in the world, but that doesn't guarantee success. Sometimes it's right place, right time, being very articulate about what it is that you do and your artwork. So there's many givens, so it's all chance in many ways. Like I was explaining earlier about just being kind of a little bit flippant by saying, yeah, I'm going to be inside of a football field. Well, it was something I had never done in that scale before by myself. So that there was a challenge to it. And when that little kid asked me about, is there any doubt?
I can't have that because I only have a certain amount of time to accomplish something in that space. And I start with all these doubts. It's kind of like being a writer and you just start to look at the paper in front of you and it's blank and you're like, what should I write? You're defeated before you begin. It's just like, that's something. It doesn't make sense, it's okay. So for me, that's an important part of my work. I like to experiment, I like to push the boundaries, I like the unknown. I like to challenge myself as an artist as well, to be uncomfortable in situations as well, to attempt things. I always tell people that, you know, you can fall on your ass, you can always get back up. You know, just take a chance of it when you're in it. So for me, that's an important thing, especially for art. Is that it? Are you sure? I'm going to go away. You know, I could probably rattle off more film director names than I can painters. You know, there's a variety of art making, and sometimes people ask me when they say, "Oh, you're a painter," who do you admire? And I'll say things like John Singer Sargent, and they'll, you know, do the double take, because they don't associate him with me. It's like you do these big, you know, things. It's like, but you look at his paintings, and there's a real painter there. You look at the brushstroke. You look at things about the sensitivity about that those pieces, and it's unmatched by so many contemporary artists. But I also always called him father because it was kind of like that was somebody I gravitated to early on as somebody that I enjoyed. Garcia Torres, who is an Uruguayan painter, I like his work an awful lot. And so there's like a big, big range of people. And again, I grew up in a time frame of my work was more performance conceptual. And if I say the name Jerry Greba, nobody's like, oh, who's that? I said, oh, he's one of the Bone Boys. He was the conceptual rock and roll group. We've never heard of him. And so what? And so it's like, let me say the name Ray Johnson, the male artist. Oh yeah, the bunny movie. Yes, I remember. A Draw Like Bunny. Yes. But that's he was part of that whole movement of people. So it's kind of even the people that history hasn't even kind of gravitated to. One of the privileged things I guess I get to do is travel to different cities and go to museums. And like I said, the museum director walks you inside, and they want to show off, of course, the collection. And one of the things I usually ask the museum director is, do you have any Dustins? I'd like this, Stuart Davis. Do you have any Stuart Davis? And they're like, oh, yes, we've got six Stuart Davis. And they take you to show you that, you know, we have the Dustins. They're like way in the back over here. So I get to see firsthand a lot of stuff that you've only seen in textbooks. One thing when I was in Chicago, when I did do the talk the year after Schnabel did his talk, one of the women that owned, that was hosting the cocktail party after my talk, had like all of the Louise Magrittes in her place. And her living room was like Magrittes. And she goes, well, would you like to see our museum? So, you know, me and my show, it's like really nice. And, you know, to compliment me on my taste, she says, you speak English very well. Impeccable, isn't it? Yes, I was born here. Yeah. Another thing that happened to me that I don't think that happens to a lot of other artists and is, I can talk a lot. So museums usually ask me, would you like to do this TV talk show? Would you like to do this radio show to promote the exhibition? And I'm usually, yeah, okay. The other artists are like, no, they can't be in front of people all day long. And so I'll say, yeah, I'll go do it and promote the show. So in San Diego, the San Diego Museum, I was asked to do a TV talk show.
And so I told the people, you know, I'm a product, so I'm taking the train down. And so I did the TV talk show, promoted the show at a museum in San Diego. And in the middle of the night, I realized that there was no train coming back to Los Angeles. And so I had to catch the Greyhound bus, because I had to catch a flight while I was flying the kite. I had to catch a flight at the airport to get to another city, because I was opening up in another show. And I had to make that connection, because the show was like the next day. So I'm on the Greyhound bus, reading this book, this French filmmaker, Alain René. I'm the only one that has the light on him. Everybody else on the bus is blonde and blue eyes, and they all have surfboards. And so in San Clemente, the bus pulls into immigration. And there I am with my Alain René book, the French filmmaker, and immigration comes up to me, passes everybody else up on the bus. They're all like looking like, is he a terrorist? And they asked, where are you going? Los Angeles. Say the Pledge of Allegiance. And I'm thinking, yeah, I've erased it from my mind, I should know it. I'm a Yankee Doodle Dan. No, that's not it. I couldn't remember the Pledge of Allegiance at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, I don't know. And they said, how many football teams does Los Angeles have? I said, wrong category. I don't know that either. Get off the bus. Go into this room, the immigration is in there. What were you doing in San Diego?
I was on a TV talk show.
They start to laugh. We've never heard that one before.
Yeah, good job. That's pretty good. Why were you on a TV talk show?
Because I'm having a show in the museum. And they said, what's in your bag? And I said, oh, you know, all these magazines, and Elle, Vogue, British Vogue, all these art publications. Because the person that was hosting the TV talk show wanted to read them before he asked me questions. And so they get the bag, they take it into an office, they look through it. Half hour, I'm sitting there waiting for them to come out. They come out, get out of here. Go back onto the freeway, standing waiting for the next Greyhound. The sun's coming down. Oh, I hope I can make it. Can't even go back to my studio. I'll just go to the airport. Go to the airport, barely catch my flight, fly to the next city that I have to be at really quick. And there's the big opening, you know, the mayor, the senators from the city, everybody's there. It's like, Ron, we just love your work. It's so wonderful. I'm so glad that you're here's the key. And I'm like thinking, like, just a few hours ago, I was a second-class citizen out there in the middle of nowhere. Where were you with that? What can I do with this key? So, you know, things like that have happened that I don't think happens to a lot of other artists, which is interesting. So thank you for coming.